What is the world that you would like to create? What is the point? Like, what do you as an individual want to be doing? What do you think that society would be happier or better off doing?
Okay, so God, Adam, and Eve are all in the Garden of Eden, and God is super pissed off. Because Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit, God told them not to do it, but they ate it anyway. So he's like, "Hey, what are you guys doing?" And Adam's like, "Oh, Eve is the one, she's responsible, she like made me eat the fruit." And Eve is like, "No, it's the snake's fault." God's like, all right, shut up, shut up. You ate the fruit, you weren't supposed to, so now I'm gonna curse you." And God says, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground." Now, whether or not you believe in the Bible, for thousands of years, humans really have had to toil with the ground to get their food. Back in the day, humans were all hunter-gatherers, and they didn't have to toil with the ground for their food. They just went out and grabbed it from the trees, like Adam and Eve. But then people started farming, and for the last 10,000 years, most people have been farmers. 95% of the population was literally toiling with the ground to get their food. But over the last few hundred years, that's changed. In the early 1800s, most Americans were farmers. Now, 1%, maybe 2% are farmers. 1880 is the year when most Americans stopped being farmers. The majority of Americans before that were farmers, after that were not. The Industrial Revolution started making farming really, really efficient. People used technology like crop rotation, fertilizers, tractors. All of a sudden, you don't need most people farming most of the time to feed everybody. So you might say, "Wow, okay, so, it used to be 90% of the population was needed to grow enough food for everyone. Now it's 1%. Why are we all still working? Why aren't we just chilling out, working a couple days a year?" What happened is, even though this huge change happened, our system did not change. We still act like we live in a world of scarcity where everybody needs to be working all the time or we're all gonna die. Technology continues to increase, continues to grow. Human labor continues to be less and less relevant, which is why every year various jobs just disappear to robots and computers and whatnot. Tech billionaires are taking more and more of the country's money, and it's not because they're like evil or something. It's just they don't need to pay people anymore because they can use computers. And so instead of living in a world of bounty where we don't have to work all the time, we still have to work all the time to live. It's just harder and harder to do that. You can't just decide to farm your plot of family land because agricultural businesses took that a long time ago. You're also competing against the new technology and the computers for jobs. And meanwhile, more and more of the money goes to the top because of this technology, so there's less and less money for good-paying jobs for most people. It's harder and harder for most people to make a living, even though technology makes it easier and easier to produce more stuff. And that's why this strange little idea has been growing. And that's what this episode is about. It's an idea with the potential to change what life as a human looks like.
This is Flipped, the show that turns the world upside down to see what falls out. I'm Alana Strauss.
Imagine if the government just gave everybody $1,000 a month. It doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor, if you're employed, if you're unemployed, everybody gets $1,000 a month. That's called universal basic income, and it's been getting very, very popular lately. A few years ago, very few people had even heard of this concept, and now it's basically mainstream. Like, quite a lot of people have heard about it. Presidential candidate Andrew Yang ran on this idea and made it incredibly popular.
There's an Asian man running for president who wants to give everyone $1,000 a month. Yeah. And I do. And the first time you heard it, it sounded like a gimmick or a joke. But this is not my idea, and it is not a new idea.
But it's a really weird idea, right? Like, when you first hear it, you're like, that's crazy. So the question is, why is this so popular? Why would so many people be into an idea that just sounds totally crazy? And I think the answer to that is that story about the forbidden fruit. It's that humans have been cursed to farm until recently, when all of a sudden we've been taken off of our farms and put in this world where we have to compete for jobs as human labor becomes less and less relevant and tech billionaires control an increasingly high portion of the money in the country. So universal basic income is taking a piece of all that money and profit that's in tech and just passing it out to people. Now, there's a lot of debate over whether this would work. Will this make people lazy? Will government ever pass this? Is it fair? Billionaires get money, etc., etc. And this podcast really isn't about that. There's so much debate already. In this episode, I'm going to say universal basic income has passed, and not just in its $1,000 a month form. Say it's in a form where people could actually choose to just work, say, part-time and otherwise have this universal basic income. You know, say it was like $2,000 a month or $3,000 a month. How would that change the world? What would our society look like if all of a sudden we were getting enough universal basic income that we didn't all have to work all the time? Okay, computers are taking like half the work. How about everybody work half-time? So that's what this episode is about. It's about going through the looking glass and imagining what a society with universal basic income could look like.
Yeah, it's fun to think about that far down the line. You know, this is going to sound very utopian.
That's Scott Santons. He's a writer who covers universal basic income. He's written for Politico, the Boston Globe, the World Economic Forum.
It's not just that you're getting money. That is an important component. But it's the fact that there are no conditions. It's not only that people need income, but they need the stability, the security, of knowing that income is going to be there and being able to plan around using it in these things. Aside from the impact on, say, the direct abolition of poverty that UBI has, it's the unconditionality of it that really enables people to live more stress-free, secure, stable lives. And also, aside from that, the unconditionality also means that there's no, say, you know, racism in the policy, that there's no disproportional impact on, say, people of color or women or those with disabilities. Like, there's all sorts of people falling through the cracks right now that with UBI, it actually reaches all those because of the lack of conditions. 50 years from now, projecting forward, and you have made things more equitable for those who are usually marginalized because they've been empowered, they're looking at a more equitable distribution of wealth and power. A lot of people of color are disproportionately less able to donate to campaigns they also would be able with UBI to have more time to spend volunteering for candidates that actually represent you, to donate to campaigns, activities that are important to the act of self-government that right now is disproportionately limited to traditionally white America.
Universal basic income has actually been tried in quite a few places. There have been trials in Finland, in Kenya, and actually Iran currently has universal basic income and has for almost a decade. So does Alaska. Alaska actually gives its citizens universal basic income, though at a much lower level than we're talking about. So trials have found that when people get universal basic income, there are a few effects. One is that very few people actually quit their jobs. The main categories of people who quit their jobs are mothers who decide to stay home with their kids, and high school students who decide to stop working their part-time jobs and instead just focus on school.
Yeah, so what does, say, the world of work look like? Especially sort of more in the future. Like, I'm sure in the short term, I guess I don't know, like, what massive things would really change in the short term, but I'm kind of wondering, like, once a policy has been established like this, like, how could work start looking different?
Yeah, I consider this kind of like a combination kind of project where there's two things that we need to reinforce each other and that we just can't rely on one or the other. When we talk about like the future of work, say automation, knowledge enhancements, and this heightened increasing productivity, we should focus purposefully on expanding leisure. We used to work 60 hours a week, as that was considered full-time, and it was a fight to bring it to 40 hours. We should go towards, say, a four-day week first, and we should normalize that, and then say, oh, well, let's do 6 hours a day instead of eight. So then you're looking at, say, like a 24-hour week, and like you just keep on reducing this down as productivity increases. What are you able to do that you can't do otherwise? And then suddenly, like, you can think of all kinds of things and also just a massive amount of bargaining power to be like, well, I'm not going to do that terrible job. You're going to have to really sweeten the deal for me to do that. I'll do that if you pay me, you know, $100 an hour. And then on the other end, too, people are going, well, there's all sorts of stuff that I'm just totally happy to do for free because I just don't need money anymore. So I'm just going to focus purely on the stuff that really provides some kind of intrinsic worth and meaning. That could be the arts, sciences, communities. It just really opens up the door for all kinds of activities.
So that's interesting. So in a world with less work, you could actually see there being more innovation.
Yeah, and I like to draw a distinction here too. I wouldn't say it's a world of less work. I would say it's a world of less maybe paid work, or maybe definitely less toil. We just don't value unpaid work, and we even say that it's not work. You know, it's like, oh, it's if you're doing care work at home, you know, if you're raising your kid or watching a family member, then that's not work. But then it is suddenly if, like, you're getting paid to do it. Imagine if all the unpaid care workers went on strike tomorrow, so that everyone just refused to work. And so suddenly everyone would have to pay money for care providers. But they would find that suddenly there's a much increased demand and no growth of supply in care providers. So suddenly they would have to pay much more for care. So I think that we can look at even childcare as being artificially cheap because of all of the care work going on. And of course, no one thinks of childcare as cheap. It's quite expensive. But that's just it, is that if there weren't unpaid care workers, it would be even more expensive. So obviously, it's really important that that work is being done, and we should value and acknowledge that work. And UBI is the only thing that actually does that, because it's actually recognizing all work, no matter what it is.
It's that you can stay at home and take care of your kids, and you still
right.
get an income for that.
Right. I think it's good to talk about just motivation itself. Get into a little bit of intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're using money as an extrinsic motivator, and intrinsic motivators are much more powerful. So autonomy, mastery, and purpose. People like to self-determine what it is that they want to do instead of being told to do it. People love to get better and better at something. And then purpose is something, you know, it's bigger than ourselves, contributing to society as a whole and our communities and other people. Like, this is really what drives us, much more so than money. And so then just looking out, like, decades in the future, I think there's much more of, like, kind of a Star Trek world from that.
Honestly, I am not that familiar with this show, so you might have to fill me in a little bit.
A lot has changed in the past 300 years. People are no longer obsessed with the accumulation of things. We have eliminated hunger, want, the need for possessions. We've grown out of our infancy.
For those who are familiar with Star Trek, there wasn't really a monetary system. You know, they didn't really have, like, money, per se. So it's not like Captain Picard was receiving, you know, the equivalent of $1 million a year to be captain / CEO of the Starship Enterprise, you know. In the Star Trek future, scarcity has been eliminated. You've got technology, it's called the replicator, to create anything anyone wants, you know. So, like, you can create food and clothing, and anything can just be, you know, manufactured out of nothing.
Great. I'm in.
So when you've defeated scarcity to that degree, the question is, you know, what is the purpose of humanity at that point? Because under the current paradigm, apparently the purpose is to get money. There's just a lot of stuff being done that people just don't care to do. And so if we don't need to do that anymore, what is our purpose? What is it that we're engaging in?
Yeah.
And so in Star Trek, what you saw was really intrinsically motivated work. So people were really mostly exploring. And I think that's, if I was going to pick one word to describe Star Trek, it would be exploration.
I've just seen a couple episodes, and I've a little bit always wondered that. Like, what is it that they're doing exactly?
Yeah, so they were exploring, you know, strange new worlds and new civilizations, and boldly going where no one has gone before. Like, humanity that was free to do whatever it wanted to, because it's all of its basic needs were met and everything, chose to explore the unknown. It really does, like, function as a vaccine. When people have economic security, not only about, like, the resources that they need, so food and housing, but also this lack of stress and economic security, then you're going to see a lot of improvements in health. You're going to see less diabetes, heart disease, even cancer. We know this because social determinants of health are actually responsible for about 90% of health outcomes. It doesn't matter if you've got, you know, this great healthcare system. You know, if you have, like, a sick population, you're going to be spending a lot of money and resources trying to make a sick population better. But if you avoid them becoming sick, you're able to use those resources elsewhere, because you don't need to use those resources on medical care because people are healthier. Let's look at, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. For anyone who's not familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's this idea that you can kind of organize our needs as humans into this kind of pyramid. And the base of the pyramid is the absolute basics. So this is the, you know, what you need for physical survival. It's food, shelter, you know, temperature regulation, these kinds of things. The next level is security. And it goes up and it goes to, you know, community. And then at the top is kind of basically like self-development, the more like your self-improvement, learning, bettering yourself, these kinds of things. And so the logic goes that if you're, you know, you have your basics met, then you're just always continuing up the pyramid. So it's not like you just stop at, all right, I've got my food and housing and that's all I'm going to do forever.
Just sit and eat.
Right. It's just sit and eat in your house because you got your basic needs met and that's it. Like, we all have a much greater variety of needs. And I would argue that it's even the higher areas of the pyramid that are actually more important to us. Say the bottom is important for our bodies and the top is more important for our minds, say our souls or something. And without those needs met, without those higher needs met, we can actually lose the drive to even live. Like, that's where people can even commit suicide, is because all they have are their basic needs met. There is nothing else. And so they feel kind of, what's the point? With UBI, you can imagine basically we're starting at a higher level so that none of us have to worry about that those most base levels of food, shelter, and security and these things. And it's like you're starting at the community level. You have enough resources and access to resources that you've actually removed the barriers to community, where you're actually more able to spend time with your family, spend time with friends, spend time as being part of your local community. That is really something that drives us. We're incredibly social animals. So when we have a UBI, there will definitely be more socializing, more community. And in fact, the evidence even from the experiments bears this out too, that you do see increased social cohesion, that you do see people even from different groups that usually wouldn't talk to each other actually work together. You'll even see community projects be like the first things that are planned and happen out of, like, you know, village-wide kind of basic incomes that have been tested in Namibia and India and these places. And it's just fascinating how, yeah, one of the first things that they do is, okay, what can we do as a community to build and foster our community? We're driven towards that kind of thinking and working together. If we can unleash each other, and this is what I call the Monsters, Inc. argument for basic income, actually.
Hey, is this thing on? Hello, testing. Hey, good evening, how are you? Nice to see you. I tell you, it's great to be here in your room. Where are you from?
I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
I am. That one I've seen.
Okay. So the Monsters, Inc. argument for basic income, the way that universe works is that monsters are actually harvesting the screams of children. And so the monster society feeds off fear, you know, portals into closets, and then they go under beds and then they scare kids and boom, that they're able to store those screams in like batteries and run the monster world. And then in the movie, they discover accidentally that a child's like laughter is actually far more energetic than the screams. So tapping child laughter and joy, they're able to actually massively improve monster productivity in the monster world and society. So they're able to, you know, just do so much more because it's like the discovery of like nuclear fusion or something versus coal power.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'll be here all week. Remember to tip your waitresses.
Great job, Mikey. You filled your quota on the first kid of the day.
Not bad, huh? You know, only somebody with perfect comedic timing could produce this much energy in one shot.
Uh-huh. And the fact that laughter is 10 times more powerful than scream had nothing to do with it.
Right now, our society runs on fear of poverty, especially. So you're constantly afraid of not being able to eat. You're afraid of becoming homeless. You're afraid of losing your job. So this, like, poverty and fear of poverty is driving our society. And if we change that and we say, let's not do that anymore, let's actually make sure that we end poverty as a, you know, it's a starting point that people start above the poverty line, that everyone has access to food and shelter, that you don't have to worry about falling into poverty because it doesn't exist anymore, then people are able to pursue what it is that they most want to pursue. And when you do that, when you have a society of people who are self-driven to do what matters to them, then I think everybody is far better off. And so I just look at all of society that way. You know, which is the better society? The society that is operating out of fear, or the society that is operating out of joy and, you know, curiosity and personal mastery and community? All these things that, humans want to do, but are necessarily kept from because of the current system. And so, yeah, I think that if we're looking towards the future, I think we should want to create that future. And I think that Star Trek comes, like, kind of the closest to envisioning that future. And I think UBI is that missing element that, once we get it in place, we'll find that we can actually make meaningful strides towards that future.
I'm definitely going to find some Star Trek footage for this.
This is the 24th century. Material needs no longer exist.
Then what's the challenge?
The challenge, Mr. Offenhaus, is to improve yourself, to enrich yourself. Enjoy it. Enjoy, 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 enjoy.
If you are unleashed and you are able to focus on anything, I think that really is something that drives humanity, especially drives scientists. And I think there would be more scientists if there were more ability to do that. Fundamental thing about humanity is that we just want to know how stuff works. And so we're just, like, really fascinated by what we don't understand. And there's this driving curiosity to answer questions and to ask new ones. And so I think that that's where we're going to go. It is creating more of a civilization like that, just constantly pushing back on that border of what is the unknown and the known.